Welcome to the podcast of The Diane Rehm Show, smart conversation and civil dialogue from WAMU and NPR in Washington.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Visa, offering the Visa Signature Card, featuring concierge services for travel, dining, and entertainment at visasignature.com.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Cathy Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane is recovering from pneumonia and she hopes to be back on the air next week. In Baghdad, bombing deaths are down 30% since the beginning of a security crackdown on February the 13th. Joining me to talk about what's happening on the ground in Iraq and what it all means, Frederick Kagan, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, Julian Barnes, Pentagon reporter for the Los Angeles Times, and from the BBC studios in London, Ambassador Peter Galbraith, author of The End of Iraq, How American Incompetence Created a War Without End, and joining us by cell phone from Amman, Jordan, is Bobby Ghosh. He is Baghdad bureau chief for Time magazine. Thank you all for joining us. Bobby, let's start with you from Jordan. You came out of Baghdad just yesterday and give us the most recent view of what's happening on the ground there. In your opinion, how much impact is the security crackdown having in Baghdad?
Well, it's had a tremendous impact, as pretty much everybody predicted it would. The most significant impact is that one side of the sectarian divide, the Shiites, have basically retired from combat. Muqtada al-Sadr, the head of the main Shiite militia, decided that discretion was the better part of valor. He has withdrawn his fighters from the streets. And that itself made a huge difference. There is still a bombing campaign that is taking place by the Sunni side, but that is scattered, not just in Baghdad and in some other places as well. But as you pointed out at the top of the program, there is a significant decline in the number of daily casualties.
What does that mean in terms of people's hopes for the future? Are you detecting a change in how people are feeling about the future of Iraq?
Not a great deal. Iraqis have learned from very painful and costly experience not to be too optimistic. There have been times in the past 4 years when there has been a lull in the combat, only for it to come roaring back after a few weeks or months. So Iraqis aren't exactly celebrating as yet. They point out, for instance, everybody I speak with there, that although there has been a reduction of hostilities, there are not that many arrests taking place. The Shiite militias are taking a break. They're not being arrested. They're not being killed. And likewise, the Sunni terrorists are not being rounded up and taken into prison. So the fear is that this lull is temporary. It is brought about by the presence of American troops in Baghdad, and that when those troops withdraw, which sooner or later they will, the Sunni terrorists and the Shiites will return and the violence will return as well.
But for the present, Bobby, are you starting to see people who had perhaps moved out of areas because of sectarian violence? For example, are you seeing those people have enough confidence to move back into their homes?
Not in very large numbers. We've heard one or two stories here and there of people come back. But equally, I'm also hearing stories of people still leaving. I arrived in Amman this morning from Baghdad, there were two or three flights leaving simultaneously, and they were almost all of them full of people with carrying lots and lots of luggage, giving every indication that they were leaving Baghdad for a long spell, at the very least, if not for good. And I know many stories of people who are still looking to get away either to Syria or Jordan. There are a few stories of people coming back, but it's not quite a trend as yet.
Okay, Bobby Ghosh, do stay with us if you can on the line there from Amman, Jordan, just out of Baghdad. Julian Barnes, from a military standpoint, how successful has the security crackdown been?
Well, I think that you can say that the Pentagon and the military leadership in Baghdad are kind of cautiously optimistic. They're making the point that it's too soon to judge, but they're very pleased that Sadr's militia has gone to ground, as they say. And the the bombing campaign by the Sunnis has them concerned, but they are pleased that the Shiite militias have stopped much of their violence.
Frederick Kagan of the American Enterprise Institute, you were a major supporter, primary supporter of the Surge plan. Is this what you expected to see?
Actually, things are going rather better than I'd expected them to go at this stage. We only have two additional brigades out of the five that are programmed to go in currently in Baghdad. The remaining brigades are going to be coming in over the next several months. We're not really going to have the force levels that I thought would be necessary to conduct major clearing operations until May or June. And I frankly expected that the enemy would surge against us, and I thought that the Jaish al-Mahdi would remain a much more cohesive force at this point in the conflict. And
when you talk about the enemy, who are you talking about?
Well, I'm talking about al-Qaeda primarily, and I'm talking about the Jaish al-Mahdi, the Shia militia of Muqtada al-Sadr, who are enemies. They are enemies of us, and they are enemies of the Iraqi people, and they've been making these horrible things happen. And I expected them to surge their violence before we had got most of our forces in country to try to take advantage of a window of vulnerability. And instead, the determination of the president, the vision of this rolling surge that was going to expand, which is something that they've never seen from us before, seems to have persuaded the Shia militias to go home. I think people are misstating a little bit when they say that no arrests are being made. That's not true. We've been continuing to pick off critical leaders of the Jaish al-Mahdi and to destroy particular cells. What we haven't been doing is rounding up everyone who was ever affiliated with the Jaish al-Mahdi. But the truth is, if you think about how counterinsurgency ends, you don't arrest everybody who ever had anything to do with the insurgency. It ends because those people go home and stay there.
Okay, but Peter Galbraith in London, we are seeing this change in Baghdad, but we're still seeing violence perpetuated particularly by Sunnis against Shias, and we saw it last week against the Shia pilgrims heading to Karbala outside of the capital, aren't we?
Yes, there have been temporary respites before, and with more forces, this respite may last longer. But the fundamental problem in Iraq is that the country has broken up and is in the midst of the civil war. This week, the Pentagon at last admitted that Iraq is in a civil war. In fact, of the civil wars since World War II, this is, by in terms of total number of casualties, I think the seventh most deadly. And in those circumstances of civil war, the Iraqi army and police are not neutral guarantors of public safety. They are either Sunni or Shiite. And in fact, the Sunni police tend to be insurgents or insurgent sympathizers. The Shiite police have included the death squads. The army is divided almost entirely among battalions that are purely Kurdish, purely Shiite, purely Sunni. And so there's no force that can fill in behind us and provide security that will be trusted by both Sunnis and Shiites. And that remains the root of the problem, along with the fact that Iraq's government is not a government of national unity, but a sectarian Shiite government, closely aligned with the Shiite militias, including the Mahdi army, that wishes to define Iraq as a Shiite state. That is totally unacceptable to the Sunnis. And, of course, the Kurds are basically de facto independent.
Okay, we'll get more onto the political situation later. Bobby Ghosh, I want to talk to you a bit more, though, about what's happening in terms of security. And particularly, you were in Iraq last week during the Holy Week when Shia pilgrims were heading down to Karbala. There was this attack, a Sunni attack against Shia. It was clearly designed to inflame sectarian violence. The Shia didn't respond, though, did they? And tell us a little bit more about that incident and what it tells you about the success or otherwise of the surge.
Well, there were actually several incidents. There were several suicide bombings that took place on one day. There were more than 100 killed, and then there were large numbers on other days. And one of the early responses from the pilgrims was to call on the Jaish al-Mahdi to return to the fight. I mean, the immediate visceral reaction when you're attacked is to turn to a force that you feel will protect you. And many pilgrims were heard to say they wished that the Mahdi army of Muqtada al-Sadr was there to protect them. Al-Sadr decided not to respond, and that is both militarily and politically the smartest thing for him to do, I think. The key point here is that Sadr is not going anywhere. His forces aren't going anywhere. They have time on their side. They have they are going to remain in Iraq, and they are fully aware, as are the Sunni terrorists, that with all the debate and controversy taking place in the U.S. over the surge in Iraq, sooner or later, whether it is weeks, months, or even years, the Americans will withdraw. And as Dr. Goldberg says, when that happens, there will be no force in the country that can act as a neutral guarantor of security. And I suspect that will be the point when the hostilities resume.
Bobby, how long do you think Shia patience will last in the face of these Sunni attacks and from Shia civilians who are saying, as you just mentioned, that they no longer have the Mahdi army to protect them against these attacks?
It's hard to say how long the patience will last. A couple of things need to happen. For this patience to be sustained, the Iraqi government will have to take advantage of the lull and bring about the economic progress, which is the second part of the surge plan. We've been forgetting here that the military operation is only the first part of the plan. It is important for the economy to get going again so that the people who've gone home, the fighters who've gone home, can have something else to occupy them. That hasn't happened. My suspicion is that if there's an attack on a very large and prominent Shiite religious figure or religious site, as happened a year ago in Samarra, that might be the next flashpoint. Most Iraqis are hoping that that doesn't take place, but given the activities of Al-Qaeda in the past, that is the sort of thing I would imagine they would have in mind. And they're looking for a fight. They're gunning for one. And they will continue to provoke the Shia until they get the response they want.
Okay, Bobby Ghosh joining us there from Amman, Jordan, by cell phone. You've just come out of Iraq this morning. You are Baghdad bureau chief for Time magazine. Thanks so much for joining us with the view there on the ground of how the surge is working. Stay with us. We'll have more on the impact of the U.S. troop buildup in Iraq. Do stay tuned. I'm Cathy Kay of the BBC. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We'll be opening the phones shortly. Please do join us for this conversation, 1-800-433-8850, or send us your emails, drshow@wamu.org. I'm speaking to Frederick Kagan of the American Enterprise Institute, Julian Barnes of the Los Angeles Times, and Ambassador Peter Galbraith, who is joining us from London on the status of the U.S. surge in Iraq. Julian Barnes, just give us some sense of how far along the U.S. troop increase is going, because it's not actually complete yet, is it?
Oh, it's just in its beginning stages. We have, as Fred mentioned, there are essentially two brigades already arrived. One has begun their operations in Baghdad. The second will begin those operations next week. The third brigade is starting to flow into Kuwait. But we have two more brigades to go before it's all built up. The U.S. has started to build the combat outposts or the small neighborhood bases that they've talked about. We don't have any numbers yet. They're kind of keeping a close hold on that. But they have about 20 of the 31 planned sort of joint police stations up and running. They've started to put barriers around the marketplaces to try and stop some of these bombings. But the eventual plan to create sort of, quote, gated communities in some of these neighborhoods has not yet begun. So it's very much in the early stages.
Frederick, how do you respond to what Bobby Ghosh was saying there about Iraqis' concerns that the sectarian fighters, particularly the Shia militia, might have faded into the sort of crowd, as it were, for the moment, but that they might reemerge if and when American forces leave?
Well, it's possible that that will happen, but it's very important to keep in mind that most of the people who form the Mahdi army are not really seriously committed fighters who are going to go down with the ship no matter what. That's true in any insurgency. Most fighters in an insurgency join a cause when they think it's going to be successful and flee when they think it's going to fail. And they are heavily reliant on a core leadership cadre to keep them focused and motivate them and tell them what to do. We've been going after that core cadre very, very aggressively and with the full support of the Maliki government, something that we have never had before in our efforts to do that. We've been conducting regular raids into Sadr City and Shab and Ur, critical Shia neighborhoods that have been the bases of the Jaish al-Mahdi, and we have been taking out critical leaders of that organization. And so it's not the case that that organization has simply faded into the woodwork and is untouched. And it's not really the case, in my view, that time is on their side, because as we continue our aggressive approach to degrade that organization, Muqtada al-Sadr is losing fighting power every day, not so much from the sort of private soldier-type fighters that we're not rounding up, but from the really critical leadership nodes that we have been taking into.
So you're confident that American forces could leave in, say, a year or whatever it's going to be, and Shias and Sunnis could work out a political solution?
I think it's possible to create the preconditions for that kind of success. I think that, you know, in war, everyone wants guarantees that everything's going to work out okay, and the problem is there's never been a war where you can give a guarantee that everything's going to work out okay. The question is, and it's far too soon to tell at this point what's going to happen, but I think the initial signs are far more positive than I would have expected to see.
Peter Galbraith, speaking to us from London, what do you make of that?
I think Frederick Kagan is much too optimistic about the disappearance of the Sadr movement. The Sadr movement, which isn't just Muqtada al-Sadr, but goes back to his father, who was murdered by Saddam in 1999, the Saddam regime engaged in a brutal crackdown on it. Before 2003, the Americans had no idea that this movement existed. In fact, many of the other mainstream Shiite parties had no idea this movement existed. As soon as Saddam was gone, it emerged. It has become the dominant force in Baghdad. It's got lots of support in the south. We're going to hold local elections in Iraq. It may win a number of southern governorates. So I think that movement is there, and it will retain its fighters. I think Sadr has followed the first rule of guerrilla warfare. When the enemy attacks, retreat, as Mao Zedong said.
But Fred Kagan's premise seems to be that peace can be self-perpetuating.
When we've established the conditions for it, I think, look, I mean, you've got to face the facts on the ground. It's not the case that movement has been allowed simply to withdraw unharmed. That we have been attacking that movement. We have been killing the worst of these guys. We have been taking out death squads. And look, how much of a problem is it over the long term if you have a Sadrist-type movement that is fully engaged in the political process and not engaged in sectarian warfare?
This movement is both in the political process and it is the militias. It
right, right
a
now that's the case.
Important part of the government. Incidentally, these are close allies of the prime minister,
who's nevertheless allowing us to target their leadership.
He told Muqtada al-Sadr to take a dive. All the moves have been signaled to the Sadrists. The degree of their infiltration in this government, it isn't really infiltration, they're full partners, could be seen at the execution of Saddam Hussein. The Maliki government couldn't even put together an execution squad that did not include the Sadrists, and therefore you had the former dictator tormented on the gallows. It is every place.
Okay, Peter, I just want to get back to the surge and particularly how that's working at the moment. Julian Barnes, we've looked at Baghdad and what's happening in the capital. Let's talk a little bit more about the rest of Iraq and the impact that this surge is having on other areas.
Yeah, I mean, we do see some indication that some fighters who have left Baghdad have gone to other areas like Diyala, and the U.S. has responded by trying to move some forces there. But, you know, the military has made the case for a while now that Baghdad is their prime objective and that that's where they're going to be focusing on. But what could change all of this is this prospect of a spectacular attack like Samarra, and that is what the military, both in Baghdad and in Washington, is very worried about. They feel like right now that they're containing the Shiite militias, but that could all change if they assassinate Sistani or they blow up one of the mosques in Najaf or Karbala.
In the meantime, you've reported on the divisions within the Pentagon for those in favor of the surge and for those in favor of a more advisor-type role to the Iraqi government. How strong are those splits and who's dominating the argument at the moment?
Well, right now, the argument is being dominated by the military officers who support the Petraeus vision, this sort of counterinsurgency tactics that Fred Kagan has laid out and that we're doing in Baghdad right now. But the view that the U.S. had been advocating for many months, the sort of most carefully articulated by General John Abizaid, the outgoing Central Command head, is that, you know, too many U.S. forces create antibodies. And he has – there are a lot of people within the Pentagon who believe that that was right, and they want to see – at some point, a move back to the advisors to withdraw some of this combat power and be able to have a longer-term but much smaller presence. Now, it's probably inevitable we go to that. The question is, when do you go to that and under what conditions?
Fred Kagan, when do you go to that and under what conditions?
Well, after you've established basic security and after you've helped to train and re-vet the Iraqi police, which is going on.
But how long is the commitment there for? Are you talking about a time frame of a year? Or are you talking about a time frame of 3 years? Because it could take a very long time.
Well, I think, and when we looked at the planning that we ended up proposing, we thought that a surge of the level that's going on now would be required for 18 to 24 months from when it began, and that at that point, the combination of actually aggressively establishing security for the population, which we have never tried to do in Iraq, with continuing to train the Iraqi army, which, by the way, is now larger than the army of France, just to put it in perspective when we talk about the Iraqis not stepping up. And, you know, but vetting that force, vetting the police especially, which is something else that's going on that Maliki is supporting, then I think we'll be able to begin to hand over sometime probably late in 2008. I think it should be feasible to start handing back to an Iraqi army and police that will be different from what they are now, especially the police, and that will be more non-sectarian. And in fact, we've seen this going on in Anbar province, where local Iraqi army units that had been very heavily Shia and suspected by the population for that reason, have started to recruit locally and started to work to create a better sectarian balance. So this is not something where we're simply going to take the current Iraqi forces, project them 2 years into the future, and try to hand this over to them. We're working aggressively to improve those forces, both in terms of their quality and in terms of their makeup, as we go forward and establish security for the Iraqi people. It's all part of the plan.
Peter Galbraith, you have close ties to the Kurds in the north of the country. You've been acting as an advisor to them. How are they viewing the surge and what's happening in the rest of Iraq?
Well, officially, they support it. And they've deployed two Kurdish brigades to Baghdad. These are units of the Iraqi army, supposedly, but really they're loyal to the Kurdistan regional government. But beneath that, they have no expectation that the surge will succeed. They basically have done this not because they have any commitment to Iraq, but because the Americans have asked them to do it. And when they deployed their units to Baghdad, about half of them deserted. And since these are disciplined units, they could only have deserted with the local government looking the other way, or indicating there wouldn't be serious punishment. The Kurds are deeply worried that the deployment of Kurdish troops to Baghdad will draw them into Iraq's civil war. So far, they've stood apart. But if they're used to fight Sunnis in Baghdad, there's the danger that the Sunni insurgents will retaliate against the Kurdish population in mixed areas, notably in Mosul, Iraq's third largest city, where the eastern part of the city is Kurdish. And if they are used against the Shiite militias, they worry that Muqtada al-Sadr will retaliate against the Kurds in Kirkuk, where some of the settlers who were brought in by Saddam are Shiites who are loyal to al-Sadr.
Okay, I'm Cathy Kay of the BBC. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones now. If you'd like to join us, please do call 1-800-433-8850 or send us those emails, drshow@wamu.org. Let's go to the phones now. Let's go to Bernie in Texas. Bernie, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. I do have some Mideast experience, and what I've just heard now is the three basic theories. I think it was Mr. Grace, who has the Kurdistan experience and knowledge, say the way it is, because that is the way it is. I heard Mr. Galbraith say both what it is and how it might be, with some luck and some fortuitous events happening on the ground. Then I heard Mr. Kagan say the rosy scenario theory or the reverse domino theory. If we play our game right and we do everything right, and this will happen, that will happen, the next thing will happen, and on and on and on, and that's why we're there in trouble to begin with. It is a very difficult situation, and quite candidly, with my experience, and I've been against this war from scratch, the time is to plan now to get out and hope for the best and leave the Iraqis in charge of their own country with some funds that we probably dearly owe them, having just broken their country into pieces. Thank you.
Okay, Bernie. Julian, how strong is the appetite for just getting out at the moment at the Pentagon?
I think that it is. It's not that strong. A lot of the military officers I talk to very much believe that we owe it to Iraq to try at least one more time to get it right, and that if we withdraw now, the violence that we have seen over the last year will double or triple. And I've heard many officers talk really passionately about that and said, you know, it may not work, but we need to try one more time to get it right, just to prevent the kind of death we might see if we withdraw.
Okay. Darius in Texas. Darius, you've been waiting to speak to us. You're on the air now.
Yes, ma'am. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, my concern is last century, the threat was communism, but this century is Islam. If we analyze the situation and think about what really happened, first of all, the West used the Islam against the communism about three decades, removing of the Shah, giving power to the Khomeini, helping the against the Russians.
Darius, I'm sorry, your phone line, I think you're speaking to us on a cell phone and the phone line is breaking up. I'm going to have to drop this line because I can't hear you well, but I do want to pick up on the point that you were making, not about the Shah, but about Iran and how much of an important part in the potential for peace and security in Iraq Iran is, Fred Kagan.
Well, Iran has been a force for anything but peace and security in Iraq. But I think that the relationship that Iran has to the problem now is very complicated. The Iranians are very promiscuous in their support of people who are attacking us, and I think they're supporting Sunni fighters as well as Shia fighters, and they support just about any Shia group that will attack us. And they are clearly trying to keep us bogged down and clearly trying to lead to defeat here. The problem is that the Iranians don't control the groups that they support, and the sectarian violence that we've been seeing in Iraq is fundamentally an internal dynamic within the country. It's very far from clear to me that the Iranians could order Muqtada al-Sadr, of all people, or even Abdulaziz al-Hakim, to stop fighting and have that work. And so the notion that what we need to do is to talk to the Iranians and make some kind of deal, maybe, I don't know, give them their nuclear program, which doesn't seem like such a good idea, to get them to turn off the violence in Iraq is just not feasible.
Alongside, of course, Peter Galbraith in London, alongside the security surge has been a commitment to have some sort of political solution that involves sitting down with the Iranians and the Syrians. How is that progressing?
Well, the first point, I'm going to agree with Fred Kagan. I don't think the Iranians are part of the solution in Iraq because they're even more enthusiastic about the Maliki government than we are. We basically created a situation in which the Shiite religious parties that Iran has supported for decades are in power in Baghdad, and the Iranians want the surge to succeed. They want that government to exercise greater power. And so there's not much more that can be done with the Iranians on Iraq. I do think we should talk to them.
So you don't support the idea of talking to them, or you do?
No, I do. But I support talking to them about the nuclear program. We don't have a military option. The Bush administration's given them a free pass for the last 3 years. And we've gotten no place by refusing to talk. What can we lose by talking? We may not solve it. We may not make progress, but it can't hurt. So,
okay.
Yes, I think we should talk to them about the issues that divide us, but let's not expect much help on Iraq.
Okay. Coming up, your calls and questions for our panel on Iraq. Do stay tuned.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. Additional support for NPR comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, and from the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities, on the web at wkkf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
A Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist tells the hidden and horrific stories of whites in counties in the American South and Midwest who banded together to force blacks to flee their homes in the decades after the Civil War. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. I'm Cathy Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm for this discussion on Iraq and the surge and how it's working. Please join us by phone, 1-800-433-8850, and send us those emails, drshow@wamu.org. I'm going to go to one of the emails now. Matt writes to us, will the educated middle class return to Iraq? Many who had the means to left the country. If the refugees feel the country is secure and turning the corner, they will return. I think this scenario will be the true measure of success. Fred Kagan, we heard at the beginning of the program Bobby Ghosh, who had just come out of Baghdad this morning, saying that people are still leaving. How important is it to the political future of Iraq and the security of the country that those refugees feel they can return?
Well, it's extremely important, and it's extremely important to Iraq, and it's extremely important to the region. You now have more than 1 million Iraqi refugees in Jordan, and that is something that's going to be very destabilizing.
And more in Syria.
And that's going to be something that can be very destabilizing to those regimes. This is one of the reasons why I've always felt that the notion of just sort of letting this go with all of the predictable spillover and increase of refugee flow in the region is a terrible, terrible idea. But I think it would be incredibly unrealistic to expect people to start returning at this point in the operation when we've just started to get going, and when it's not, of course, clear what the ultimate outcome will be. And it's possible that there will be, in fact, I think it's likely that there will be an upsurge in violence as we begin our serious clear and control operations, and the enemy will resist. So who in his right mind would choose this moment to start returning? The test will be, hopefully, if things go properly, by the end of the year, we will have the levels of violence down significantly, and people will begin to have confidence that that will be sustained, and then you'll start to see a reverse flow back into the country.
Okay, we spoke...
Peter. Let me just point out, the problem here comes from thinking of this as a single country. Who are the people who are leaving? They are largely Sunni, and they're largely the secular elite, the very people that we hoped would be running Iraq in 2003, those people aren't going to go back, because even if the level of violence declines, the character of the country is very different from what they wanted. On the other hand, in Kurdistan, you actually have an influx of educated people from the diaspora that have left over the decades of brutal repression. And I suspect you also may have Shiites coming back to some of the secure areas in the south. And this is a sign, just another sign, of how this country really doesn't function as a one. In different parts of the country, you have very different things happening.
And, of course, the situation in the north, in the Kurdish areas, is that the Kurds are growing increasingly in favor of a partition situation, of a divided country, aren't they?
They voted 98.5% for independence, and they really want to have absolutely nothing to do with Iraq, and they see themselves on the way out, and as the situation deteriorates, they're preparing for the day when they can be fully independent.
Okay, Julian, I just want to pick up Julian Barnes of the Los Angeles Times, a story actually that appeared in the New York Times this morning about the political goals that the Bush administration had set for the Iraqi government to meet by this month, and now it seems that those goals won't be fulfilled until the end of the year. How important is that?
Well, that is a key part. I mean, part of this surge is to buy time for those sort of political compromises, reconciliation, changes to be made. So far, the Iraqis haven't been able to come to agreement on reforming their de-pathification. They haven't made substantive alterations to the constitution. And there's a whole range of these political milestones that they haven't gotten to meet. And, you know, that's the other part of what General David Petraeus and the new ambassador in Iraq are trying to do, which is use their diplomatic skills to force the Maliki government and force the Sunni minority to come to the table and make these hard compromises.
Let's open the phones now. Again, Suma from Bowie in Maryland, you're in the air. Suma, can you hear us? You're on the air.
Yes, I'm here.
Please go ahead.
Yes, hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I was going to say is I think if we have a reconciliatory approach with the way we deal with Murtada al-Sadr, based on the premise that he is for a centralized government in Iraq, as opposed to what the other Shia people are asking for, and a centralized government is the position the Sunnis want to go for, and I believe if there is a reconciliatory way of approaching Murtada al-Sadr, especially at this moment when we have proven to him that we can quell him, we can crush him if he dare raises his head in a violent approach, this is the best time to send an olive branch to him and try to take him on the basis of the position that he has, that is in line with the Sunnis, to bring other Shiites in that same position and be able to have a much, centralized government that is accepted by the rest of the other factions in Iraq.
Okay, Suma, let me put that to Fred Kagan. Suma, a more conciliatory approach to Muqtada al-Sadr.
Well, I think it's a huge mistake. I think that we are in a situation where both Muqtada al-Sadr and Abdulaziz al-Hakim are both major political players and have militias that, especially in Sadr's case, have been causing significant problems. It's very important to make clear two things to them. First of all, that the Iraqi political process will succeed and that they should address their grievances through that process. And second of all, that any attempt to use force to gain greater leverage in that political process will fail. As long as the Jaish al-Mahdi continues to be an armed force outside the law and outside the Iraqi government, it should be brought to heel. It should be disarmed. This is the stated position of the Maliki government. It's the stated position of the U.S. government, and it's been something that we've been undertaking. And I think we need to continue to do that. Now, in the course of that, we made the decision in 2004 to try to bring Muqtada al-Sadr into the political process, but we did not prevent him from maintaining this militia that gave him additional leverage. It remains to be seen whether he can actually be a constructive force in Iraqi politics, but he certainly should not be allowed to do so while he continues to control a militia of any variety.
Okay, any discussion? Go ahead, Peter.
Look, I think the fundamental problem here is that the kinds of steps of reconciliation that are being proposed are not going to accommodate the Sunni population. What they object to, what they're not concerned about de-Ba'athification or some small changes in the Constitution, which is all that's possible, or a share of the oil revenues, especially 20% since they used to have 70%. What they object to is the fact that the Shiites now rule Iraq and that it is defined as a Shiite state. And the Shiites have no intention of defining Iraq differently. For them, this is a moment that's been 1,300 years in the making, and it is the fall of Saddam and their rise democratically in elections is an end of 80 years of repression. This is their moment. They're simply not going to give it up. And so I don't think you're going to see these steps on reconciliation. There aren't going to be significant changes to the Constitution. For one thing, the Kurds would never agree to a more central role in Iraq. De-Ba'athification, that should be easy. It isn't happening because it goes to this fundamental divide.
And yet the Sunni sheikhs in Anbar province have turned against al-Qaeda, are attacking it and driving it out of the province, and Maliki just went to Ramadi to negotiate with them.
But a key part of this clearly is going to be the oil, and there is a lot of pressure on Prime Minister al-Maliki to get an oil law passed. Let's go to the phones now because we do have a caller who wants to ask about that question. Bill in Florida, you're on the air. Bill? Hello, Bill.
Hello.
Bill, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. I'm calling from Miami.
Yep.
And the question is, apparently there's a bill now in the Iraqi that's been passed by the cabinet but not the Congress yet that pretty much privatizes the oil, putting it into the hands of international oil companies, the big four, about 80%, and everything undiscovered. And I don't know how many people in Iraq could even know about this, but as soon as it becomes known, and especially if it passes, our presence there becomes a complete sham.
Okay, Bill, we've also had an email on this question. Julian Barnes, how will this affect the distribution of oil profits in Iraq?
Well, the profits that are left, which is about 20% after giving most of it to international oil. I mean, it's like taking 80 and saying you can have 20 left.
Okay.
Nobody's going to like that. It's going to galvanize the entire area against what's going to be viewed as American imperialism.
Okay, let me put that to Julian Barnes. Julian, how important is it how the oil is distributed, and what does this bill that's in the Iraqi parliament do?
Yeah, I should say off the to start with that I'm not an expert at this, and maybe Fred or the ambassador can jump in, but it is important. My understanding is that the sort of framework has passed, but a lot of the details are still yet to be hammered out here. I mean, this has been a real sticking point about who should get what. And the Kurds are sitting on a lot of oil in the north, and the divided city of Kirkuk has the bulk of that. So this is a critical question that goes to whether Iraq can stay whole, because if you don't figure out how to share the oil, you can't keep the country together. And, of course, although there may be some oil in Anbar province, where the majority Sunni province, it does not have any active oil wells. And as the ambassador pointed out, the Sunni share of oil has dropped since they've been forced out of power.
Fred Kagan, will the Sunnis ever accept having 20% of the share of oil revenues when they had 70% before?
I think that there's a lot of evidence that the Sunni tribal leadership, especially in Anbar, has come to realize that the notion that it is going to retake Iraq and reestablish a Sunni-dominated Iraq has evaporated, that is not going to happen. And the evidence of that is that they have turned against what had been the principal fighting weapon that they had to use to gain political leverage, which was al-Qaeda in Iraq.
We're still seeing, though, Sunni attacks on Shias.
We're still seeing,
as we did last week in last
yes,
numbers.
We're seeing al-Qaeda is continuing to fight, but the interesting thing is that they are increasingly flowing out of Anbar, which is becoming an extremely inhospitable environment for them, because the Sunni sheikhs in Anbar have banded together. They have sent their sons to police academies, to police training. The police forces in Ramadi and Fallujah are now overstrength with the sons of tribal leaders who are going after al-Qaeda. So I think there's a lot of evidence, actually, that the Sunnis are increasingly adjusting themselves to the reality of the new situation. And I think that will continue as we bring peace to the area. And again, I think it was a tremendously positive step that Maliki actually went to Ramadi to meet with them.
I'm Cathy Kay of the BBC. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join us, please do call 1-800-433-8850. Let's go again to the phones and to Robert in Texas. Robert, you're on the air.
Hey, Cathy. I thank God for the BBC and the objectivity that it brings to us.
Well, thank you.
As a Republican, as a conservative, as a veteran, it just makes me crazy to see the extent to which the government of Israel is manipulating and controlling and influencing what we do militarily in the Middle East. Dick Cheney went to the AIPAC convention 2 days ago, and he was advocating the same thing that the AIPAC executive director was advocating. These people not only want us to send more troops to Iraq, they want us to start war against Iran. And I'm saying that when you look at who brought us into this war originally, you know, Wolfowitz, Libby, Crystal, Pearl, all these people have a vested interest in what is best for Israel and not what is best for the United States. And when you listen to...
Okay, Robert, do you have a question for our panel?
Yeah, I just want to know, what the heck are we inviting Robert Kagan, Fred Kagan, and people from the American Enterprise Institute to comment on this? Their opinions are no more valid.
Okay, Robert. Okay. Well, I think it's very important that we do get a range of opinions on the panel, and we would be we're delighted to have Fred Kagan on with us this morning. Thanks very much for joining us here on the panel, Fred Kagan. Let's go to another caller now, and Patrick in Manhattan. Patrick, you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. I've been following the Iraq war before it even started. As soon as George Bush came on power, I believed something was going to happen with Saddam. I'm not a supporter of Saddam. I know exactly what he did. But it seems to me that we don't have a plan. We're just guessing when it comes to Iraq. And I heard the gentleman talking. They don't have no belief that something's going to change in Iraq. They just hope something will change. And one other thing before I ask my question is, yesterday I was watching TV. It seems like the government, the U.S. government now, is giving a weapon to the Sunnis to fight al-Qaeda in Iraq. And I do have a strong belief, as soon as these guys finish with al-Qaeda, if they finish with them, they're going to start fighting the Americans in Iraq. And this is not a good policy. The administration don't have no policy to change nothing in Iraq. They're just guessing, and we're going to leave Iraq one day like the Russian leave Afghanistan.
Okay, Patrick, your phone line is breaking up, and we're getting to the end of our broadcast. I do want to put that question to Fred Kagan. I haven't heard this this allegation that Patrick was coming up with before of you.
Well, I'm not clear exactly what the allegation was.
Supporting Sunnis. The implication is that you're getting involved, I suppose, in the civil war process between Sunnis and al-Qaeda, and that there's a direct
Well, of course we are, in the sense that we're supporting the Sunni police forces and we're supporting Sunni army units that are fighting al-Qaeda, which is what our job is. That's part of what we're trying to do is to
create... But what you're actually supporting is army units and police forces rather than specifically supporting a sectarian group
against
another group.
Absolutely.
No, I think we should be clear. We're actually supporting the Shiite government of Iraq. So we have aligned ourselves with the Shiite side in the civil war. In fact, on the same side as the Iranians, which is one reason that they're really quite happy these days. They've had such, as a result of the American invasion of Iraq, they've had the greatest strategic gain since the Treaty of Khazar-e-Shirin in 1639. And the problem is, if we continue with this strategy of trying to build a centralized Iraq, the only way the civil war will turn out is with the Shiites winning and driving the Sunnis from Baghdad, and then who knows what the Sunni triangle will be. And that's why what I would argue we'd do much better to get out of the business of nation building in Iraq, face up to the fact that the country is broken up, and follow the roadmap to partition that's contained in the Iraqi constitution, have the Sunnis form their own region as the Shiites are moving to do, and then one can hope, and maybe what Fred Kagan says, although I think he's very optimistic, maybe those sheikhs in Anbar will be prepared to take on al-Qaeda.
Okay. Ambassador Peter Galbraith, author of The End of Iraq, How American Incompetence Created a War Without End. Thank you very much for joining us here on the Diane Rehm Show from London. Julian Barnes, Pentagon reporter for the Los Angeles Times, thank you. And Frederick Kagan, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, thank you all for joining us here on the Diane Rehm Show for this discussion. The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Anne Adams, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Anisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, cassette and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. I'm Catty Kay of the BBC and I'm sitting in for Diane Rehm. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new 240-horsepower turbocharged Acura RDX. More at acura.com/RDX.